I am investor and publisher of A Bizarro World, Nick Hodge. I am without my trusty co-host and oftentimes host, Gerardo Del Real, who is on the road this week. And so you get my rantings and ravings instead of our rantings and ravings. This is the 375th episode, which means we've been going for quite a while now. I'm going to talk a little bit about dollar weakness and yields and correlations. I'm going to talk about copper and tariffs and production slash supply. I'm going to talk about executive orders and presidential determinations as it relates to critical minerals. I'm going to talk about the bullish case for uranium. I'll do a little bit on midterms and fires, and then we'll get into the premium portion of the podcast where I'll give you some of the things that I'm buying that are in either my or Gerardo's portfolios. Excuse me, I ate my lunch too fast before we started recording. I'm going to share my screen for a bit, likely for the majority of this podcast, in fact, and we'll go through some charts and we'll go through some articles that I've been looking at. So let me get that squared away. We'll share the entire window. We'll look at the 10-year yield first. And here we go. Yep, looks like that's coming through okay. So 10-year yield here, as we've been discussing, is bullish. It has a trend line here that is in no danger of being broken. We had a Fed meeting in and around here the third week of June, and rates in terms of the 10-year have continued to go up. For a while, it was these upward trending rates that were keeping a lid on gold. That started to soften a little bit. I'll talk about that in a second. But bond yields themselves are not softening. If we just flip over to the 2-year, we'll see that that was a little weaker. It sort of touched its trend line a couple of weeks ago here before the Fed met. And Kevin Warsh said that he was content to let the market do its thing. And then you'll see that we had an upward resumption of the U.S. 2-year yield, and it's teetering right around its trend line. If I scroll back, you can see where that bullishness and yield started here in the last weekend of February, which, of course, is the start of the Iran war. And they continue to go up, but the 2-year teetering a little bit more. And I would submit that's likely a result of yo-yo inflation, right? I mean, if you track this with oil prices, which might be fun to do, I guess, for a second while we're at it. Likely doing the same thing. You see up oil prices when this was truce on, truce off, and oil spiked back up into the end of the July. And then it seems like we're getting closer to a deal here. And oil prices, bond yields have come down. So, and that's reflected in the CPI as well. You had, I think the May print was something like 4%. June started to come down 3.5-ish%. And you'll likely toggle around there for a little bit. So let's remove the indicator. Let's look at the gold price. Actually, let's look at the dollar for a second. This is what I wanted to talk about. You'll see, so we had a really good week, at least relative to the last couple of weeks of summer here, where it's been really bearish in the precious metals market. And that's a result of gold, the dollar going down, excuse me. So you had a dollar that was strong May, June, July, up over 100, 101 on the DXY. And then just in the past couple of really days here, you've had the dollar soften and start to get more comfortable. In fact, short-term bearish, below 100 on the DXY. And that's what's allowed gold to add to $250 in the past couple of trading days, down from, or up from, I should say, 2040, 2050 to nearly getting up to, 4040, 4050, nearly getting up to $4,300. Trading today around 4250 thereabouts. So let's look at the correlations, and then I want to talk about the levels of gold for a second as well. So let's get into gold here. I wanted to look at correlations, so let's get those up. I
It's correlated to the U.S. 10-year first.
So this is what I was saying there. In March, April, May, gold was inversely correlated to the dollar. You can see a negative correlation here below zero down on this blue line. That meant that bond yields were going up during this time, and the gold price was going down. It was inversely correlating. What's happened over the course of June, July, and as we head in here into August, is those traditionally inverse correlations have dissipated to a point where you're starting to get zero correlation here, or at some points even a positive correlation, i.e. Bond yields up, gold up, which we've seen over the past couple of days. So it was the yields that were firmly in charge, but that's changed over the past couple of days to gold being more correlated or inversely correlated to the dollar. So that's what I wanted to show you. If I could type here. So dollar correlation to gold now, you know, pretty firmly negative in June and July, and here in August, where, you know, you're zero correlated or positively correlated on yields. If we put DXY on the chart here, you can drill down into 5 days, and you can see, or maybe even a month, that that's what's happened here. The dollar has softened down into the right, and gold has gone up. Now, why has the dollar softened is probably a good question. I think it's a combination of factors. Talked about the end of, well, maybe not the end of the war, but at least approaching a new sort of truce or a new sort of deal, or at least that's the talk we're getting. I know there's been a lot of on-again, off-again deals over the past several months, but this one seems to be closer. Oil has come down as they seem to approach a deal for opening slash controlling the strait. And also, I think you're back to, in fact, not I think, you know, there was a picture of Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent's to-do list, which was buy Japanese yen, which of course means your tax dollars are intervening in global currency markets. And that means, or at least has translated to, a weaker dollar, because we're back to Treasury Department and potentially even some sort of off-balance sheet Fed interactions in the market. So that's not pure capitalism, obviously, and I'm not in favor of that, but that's what your government does, no matter who's in charge. And Mr. Bessent here knows that they're heading into midterms and they're starting to intervene in markets. They want a weaker dollar to do a couple of things, but mainly support asset prices. And certainly they've accomplished that with the S&P hitting new all-time record highs here in the past couple of days. So that's yields and correlations. Let me see what else I wanted to talk about while the chart is up. Actually, before I get to that, let's trash some of this stuff. Let's talk about just gold prices for a second. So what I've been saying and Gerardo and I have been talking about is and a line we used a couple of times during these June and July months was the beatings will continue in the precious metals or commodity space until the macro improves. And by the macro improving, that meant either bond yields turning around or the dollar weakening. Well, we got the latter of that. We got the dollar weakening. And the levels I had been telling you about were gold needed to hold 4375-ish. That's about where I have my cursor here. That was near-term support. It, of course, broke down through that in early June. And the next level I was telling you about was 4,000 that needed to hold. And that's down around here. And I said if that didn't hold, let's drill down a little closer. If 4,000 didn't hold, then it was 3930. So what we saw here was the $4,000 level break. That was the extreme bearishness of late June and a little bit of early July. And the 3930 level, in fact, was never reached. It bounced off, as you can see there, 3940-ish, 3941, consolidated sideways for a number of weeks or a month, 4 weeks. And now we're getting this uptrend here. Now, I don't believe we're out of the woods yet. This is not yet turned to a bullish chart. The trend, if I had to draw a line from the peak, thereabouts, something like that, the trend is still down, right? Even if you're more generous and do it from here, trend's still largely down, right? So we haven't broken out yet. You need to get above sort of 4,300, close there for a sustained amount of days, if not weeks, to get this chart back to bullish. But as I said last week, it gives me, I guess hope is the word, or it gives me an indication, is probably a better word, an indication that this gold chart is starting to bottom and in fact wants to go higher. So those levels played out that we had been discussing, and now we look to be trying to get back to bullish. Silver level is 63. Jordan would ask me about that. So I'll look at it for a second, though I tend not to look at silver as much. It would be the sort of 63 level that you need to get above to get back to a bullish trend. You can see it would be 63 right about here-ish. Yep. So that's silver, that's gold. Let's do copper, which I'm going to talk a little bit more about beyond the charts, but let's look at the chart first. I guess we'll do this one. No, we won't do that one. Let's do the futures. Here's copper futures, all-time record highs today. This is a daily chart, all-time record highs today, $6.86 per pound of copper. All-time, if I click the button, is a long time. That's a bullish chart. It wedged a little bit to the right. It has clearly broken out. That's as bullish of a chart as you can get there. We can look at the year to date. We can see that copper is now above the all-time highs it made back in May and June. So let's talk about why for a second. Here's a Reuters article. Let me make sure my screen is changing as I go. Yep, perfect. Copper tariffs dislocation risks becoming a structural split. So here's the backdrop, some of which we've talked about on this podcast. There was initiated last July a Section 232 Commerce Department investigation into copper, from which there should have been a report delivered to the president this June. 12 months passed when it was initiated last year. And as a result of that report, there should have been a decision as to whether or not to implement tariffs on copper, which were first announced last July and were quickly reneged by the president. Surprise, he goes back and forth. What's happened is we have not seen the report. We have not got a decision about tariffs. And that indecision has led to a further stockpiling of copper in the United States. So what you see here is a chart of global exchange copper inventories. You got the London, the LME in blue and gray. You've got the Chicago Mercantile in yellow, and you've got the Shanghai in red. And as you can see, starting last July 2025, when he was first talking about these tariffs, the yellow band, which is the amount of copper inventory in the United States on the CME, has expanded and expanded and expanded and expanded. And as a result, what's happened is the amount of copper in Asia or China has gone down. You see this red bar starting to get smaller. So we've talked about this, I know we have, over the past year, this bifurcation of copper prices, where copper is more expensive in the US because people are paying more to import more of it to get ahead of any coming tariffs. And this indecision is further exacerbating that, because what the market has interpreted it as is, we don't know what this guy is going to do. If he does implement tariffs, if, when, whatever the word is, he implements tariffs, we want to have as much copper already in the country, already in the US, as possible, so we don't have to pay tariffs. And so they've continued, they being traders, hedge funds, you know, commodity traders, investors, et cetera, have continued, end users, obviously, have continued importing copper into the United States. So what's happened is China still needs copper, and now they're having to pay a premium for it. So the prices are going up, leading to that bullish chart at all-time record highs that I just showed you, even in London, the blue and gray there. There's backwardation, meaning the front month contract, copper futures contract, is trading at a premium to months 2, 3, 4 months out, indicating that there's a near-term squeeze in the amount of copper. So I don't think there's any more beneficial charts than this one. Let me change to another article. Yeah, here's the Bloomberg's talking about the same thing. I don't know why it's a little shadowy. Sorry, that's dark. I'm not sure why. I'll refresh it. I wonder what happens. There it is. This chart, you can see U.S. copper shipments surge as tariff decision looms. Well, it's been looming. It's past conditional tense for you language folks out there. It has been looming, and it hasn't come. And so we had a record. That's what this thing is here. A record July of imports, going back to what I was saying on the other page, a record July of copper imports into the U.S. And that's what's fueling these higher prices on the tariff side of things. On the other side of things is supply, and that's the next tab to show you. So we only really have to read the headline here. Codelco, which is the large Chilean state-owned, one of the largest copper producers in the world, Codelco rules out meeting copper goals as it faces a tougher year. And all that to say, one of the largest copper producers in the world is unable to not just meet its guidance, but their production has in fact been falling. There's not a good chart in here to show you, but ever since 2016 or so, I was looking earlier this week, Codelco production has been largely down and to the right. If you were to draw, again, a trend line through it, they had some improvements in 24-ish, 25-ish, but on the whole, Codelco production has been down and to the right, and you see that they're not going to meet their goals this year as well. And that's really indicative of the copper space as a whole. As we know, mines are getting older, mines are getting deeper, mines are getting lower grade. We haven't been finding as many large copper porphyry things. And that bodes well for not just the copper price, but the copper explorers and the developers in which we're invested through publications at Digest Publishing, either on the private placement side, explorers, or developers, and then even some producers in Underground Alpha. So a lot to like in the copper space, and hearkening back to the past several issues of this podcast, we've been saying that copper looks much better than gold, looks much better than silver in that order, and that has continued to play out. Doing okay on time here. Got those two things out of the way. Let's talk about executive orders and presidential determinations. So this is the executive order we briefly mentioned in a past episode. It came out on July 20th in all caps because Trump loves the caps and the exclamation points. We are securing America's defense supply chain and ensuring domestic acquisition of critical materials. All that to say, this executive order was showing you that, what is the line here I wanted to say? They need to trace, here it is. No, that's not it. Is it the one above it? Yes, the critical materials and components necessary to manufacture, maintain, sustain, and repair that equipment, i.e. U.S. military equipment, are sourced domestically and from allied nations. That means you have to be getting your copper, your critical minerals, your rare earths, your tungstens, your terbiums, your dysprosiums, your praseodymiums, your niobiums, from the domestic or friendly nations. There's a couple of problems with that, chief among them being it's nearly impossible to do given that China controls, either on the mining or processing side, 70 to 90 some percent of the production and refinement and processing of some of these metals. And that, in a nutshell, is the investment thesis for a lot of what we do around here. The government is starting to get serious about it, as evidenced by a lot of things that we've talked about over the past couple of years, even in the Biden administration, but certainly in the past couple of years of the second Trump administration, where he's done these executive orders, like the one I'm talking about now, is starting with some in early 2025, whether that's the creation of Fast 41 permitting, which some of our portfolio companies are a beneficiary of, or direct investment in companies, which they've done with companies like Trilogy Metals and Lithium Americas and some others, or whether it's through partnerships or opening up of land for exploration, or as we've seen over the past couple of weeks and months, the opening up of Army bases to put processing facilities on in Utah. And other states. This Friday, tomorrow, if you're listening to this live, the president will have lunch with several CEOs of critical metals mining and processing corporations. But they've got a long row to hoe in terms of the amount of capital that needs to be thrown at this to make any sort of dent. And so still early, very early, I would say, on the critical metals side of things as it relates to this transition. Whether that's tracking, which is still very rudimentary in the mining, and we've got investments for that, tracking from all the way from assays to exploration down through production and smelting and shipping, et cetera, or it's exploration or it's production. And side note, little anecdote, talking with industry folks, I just mentioned Trilogy Metals. Let's look at Trilogy Metals for 1 second, because why not? It's the TMQs. Let's look at their last year of news and let's see where the U.S. was going to invest. I think it was in... Does that not go back far enough? Trilogy Metals, U.S. government, enter... LOI for 10% interest. The Dow, the Department of War, was going to invest $35 million, $35.6 million at whatever it was, $2.17 a share, and they were going to get a warrant as well. And so back when that was announced, to belabor the point, shares did this. The U.S. government was going to invest at $2.17 or whatever I just said, and shares overnight went from $3 to $15, not overnight, you know, a couple of days, whatever. That deal has not yet closed. It had a deadline of March this year, 31st, 2026. That was extended to July 31st of this year. That deadline came and went. And then just this week, they told us, hey, we're pleased to provide an update, which is there is no update. Discussions with the Dow, the Department of War, are ongoing. And that thing we signed back in October 2025, it remains in effect. We just haven't really closed it yet. And the anecdote or the side note I was going to say is the government doesn't know what it's doing in a very surprising turn. It thought, and I've heard this through the grapevine, that Trilogy Metals was much closer to production than it actually is. No one told the Department of War or the Trump administration that these mines take years to build, as we've told you on this podcast and I've written elsewhere. I think the amount of time needed now, or at least what's been needed over the past couple of decades to find, explore, develop, permit, build a copper mine is somewhere up around 27 or 28 years. I guess the Trump administration and the Department of War thought that, you know, they could just flip a switch and turn on this Ambler Road project, which, surprise, isn't the case. It's years away from production. It's got no development at all. It's an exploration project with a defined resource that still needs to be built, even if it's permitted yesterday. It's going to take a year or two or more to build and then to ramp up, et cetera, et cetera. So the government is learning, and that's why I think we're still very early in this. So let me keep moving.
The other thing we got a week later, July 30th, was a presidential determination pursuant, oh, not all caps in this, I guess. Executive orders are capitalized, but presidential determinations are sentence case, as it were. Presidential determination pursuant to Section 101 of the Defense Production Act of 1950 as amended on recoverable critical minerals and materials. And what this says is, y'all best not be exporting any of the shit we need. That's exactly what it says. So he's authorizing. Who did he authorize? He authorized somebody. You are authorized. The Commerce. There it is. Secretary of the Commerce is authorized to shake his or her, it's a he, finger at anyone who tries to export any of this stuff. And not just the metals, but the swarf, in fact, which is like some of the waste material. Waste and scrap containing critical metals and materials. Y'all's not allowed to export any of that. We need it here in the United States. And that's still not going to make a huge dent, though we do have in Underground Alpha a rare earth recycling play, as well as a mine-to-magnet company that is mining, processing, and via a recent acquisition about to start producing rare earth magnets in their final form here in the United States. So that's that. We're going to get into the bullish case for uranium. I think I'm going to stop sharing my screen for 1 second. Okay. The bullish case for uranium. I'm going to read a little bit. I made some bullet points. All right. Actually, well, I'll just talk about it for a second. So we had a pretty good uranium run in the past couple of years. The price bottomed out somewhere at 16 or 17 cents a pound, went at one point 23, 24-ish, over $100 a pound, and then has since pulled back. Spot price now is something like, I don't know, $85, $86 a pound of uranium. Term price a little bit higher than that. Have heard recently of some contracts up in the high 90s or over $100 a pound. The equities have sold off rather dramatically. I guess I will share my screen for one more second. Well, no, I won't. We'll save it on the editing side. With the URA, you know, down into the right, even softer than precious metals were over the summertime, despite exceedingly bullish fundamentals. And so Rick Rule was out with a long piece on his Substack this week about, or maybe it was last week, doesn't matter, about why the second leg of uranium is up leg, obviously, of uranium is approaching. And I took the liberty of distilling that down into a couple of bullets, and I'll just give you some the headline numbers and why uranium prices can't stay where they are, and certainly uranium equities can't stay where they are. So you've got a global nuclear build-out with 438 operating reactors worldwide, and projections that figure more than doubles to 952 operating reactors, with global nuclear generation capacity growing from a current 372 gigawatts to 686 gigawatts by 2040. That's in 13 or 14 short years. As a result, you've got the World Nuclear Association saying that uranium use is going to go up from 180 million pounds a year to 390 million pounds. Everything there is basically a doubling, or just more than a doubling, in just over a decade. AI data centers, we obviously know the deal there. I'm not going to read everything from my notes, but you've got all these companies, Amazon's, Google's, Microsoft's partnering either directly with utilities or small modular reactor companies, and they're going to have to move into the fuel cycle, into the uranium portion of their section or sector of the nuclear energy space, because just like the rare earths and the coppers that I just went through, ain't not enough uranium either. Point three, ain't not enough uranium. Uranium supply is already inadequate. Current mine production estimated at 160 pounds annually, and that's already below the replacement of what we're using, 180 million pounds annually. So we obviously make up the rest through stockpiles and through blending, altering the feeding ratios, etc., and a little bit of, you know, sort of recycling. But the projected deficit becomes much larger as these new reactors come online. Shaw and Partners estimates the industry may need 240 million pounds of new uranium production over 14 years, or more than 350 million pounds after accounting for mine depletion. Goldman Sachs calling for a 2.3 billion pound uranium deficit through 2045. Let's talk about existing producers. We talked about existing producers with copper and Codelco. In the uranium space, it's the Kazakhs, not the Chileans, that dominate the uranium supply through Kazatomprom, the world's largest producer and a state-owned company. And they, like Codelco, can't meet their production guidance. They were anticipated to expand production to 80 million pounds, and they've recently said that we've got to reduce that. We can't hit the 80 million pounds annually. We can only do 60 million pounds annually. So, surprise, surprise, these existing large entrenched producers can't produce as much as they say, and when they try to expand or ramp up, they run into headwinds, and not just in Kazakhstan, but here in North America as well, with Cameco, which is the largest by far North American producer. They had some floods at Cigar Lake this year. They had to shut down the import road for supplies. They argue that they're going to make guidance, but I would submit that, you know, it's going to be at the low end of guidance if they do end up making it. So it just reinforces the argument that even established producers cannot automatically deliver the projected supply. Point five, and then we'll start to wrap up on uranium, is these utilities still need to come into the market. I mentioned we're now starting to see a bifurcation, like we are in copper and US versus LME, of the spot price versus the term price, with some folks starting to pony up $100 or more for uranium contracts. And you still got a lot to cover on the utility side of things, with a lot of plants in California and Michigan and New York receiving life extensions, operating beyond their, you know, typical operating capacity lifetime of 60 years, now being extended to 80, 100 years. They're going to need uranium now for another 20 or 40 years, and then the utilities are going to have to come in the market to buy that. And the problem is particularly pronounced, even though this is a global phenomenon with South Korea turning to nukes, Japan restarting their nukes and doubling down, saying we're recommitting to nuclear now that, you know, it's been 15 years since Fukushima. But in the U.S., we need 50 million pounds a year and only produce 2.1 million pounds. That's up from 0 pounds a couple of years ago. So we're headed in the right direction, but nowhere near covering what we need, still importing 95% of our requirements. And so you got a twofold thing going on here. You've got the global nuclear expansion, and you've got the U.S. that is already one of the largest nuclear countries in the world, if not the largest. And it's ramping up. It wants to build more. It's got SMRs coming online. We've talked about that. Headed into the July 4th holiday, we fired up 4 SMRs reaching criticality. And so you've got the world's largest nuclear utility world's largest nuclear country that needs to procure uranium for the next 15, 20 years. And that's going to lead to much higher prices. So here's the forecast. Shaw and Partners forecast $175 uranium. It's below $100 right now. They're forecasting $175 in 2027 and $200 a pound uranium in 2028, with an average long-term price of $120, some 30% higher than it is now, through 2032. And the last point is, these equities are still weak. Investor sentiment remains weak. There's been other opportunities, whether that's, you know, AI and tech stocks, or earlier this year, gold.
have just taken investors' eye off the ball of uranium, so much so that the Sprott physical trust, which is often talked about, is trading below its net asset value. You can buy the Sprott Asset Trust for less on a net asset value basis for less than the amount of uranium it holds. And that's not going to last forever. Let me see if there's any worthwhile charts. No, we'll skip right over that. Okay. Into the bizarro portion of the podcast, I believe. Not going to rant too much at you this week, but we'll rant a little bit. We've got midterm elections coming up. I already mailed in my ballot here in Washington State. We've got some interesting issues on the ballot. We've got the income tax, which was recently passed in a state whose constitution prohibits an income tax if it's not equally applied, which this one isn't. So that'll be interesting. It received, I think, something like 500 and some thousand signatures to get it on the ballot, the most of any initiative in state history. There's been an exodus of capital. Bezos has long ago moved. Howard Schultz, I believe it's Howard Schultz, the Starbucks guy, he's long been out of here. Companies are moving their headquarters here in Spokane, which is on the border of Idaho. We've seen, and I've talked to commercial real estate agents, brokers, and was reading a report yesterday about this. Companies and high net worth individuals moving 20, 30 minutes east over to the Idaho border, across the Idaho border into Idaho. That's on the ballot. The sports is on the ballot in terms of the biological males playing against the females, which we had a Supreme Court ruling about earlier this year, and that was the correct ruling. And there's a big hubbub, if that's a word, about that in the past couple of weeks with Sophie Cunningham, who we discussed, and what's the female tennis player? I believe her name is Sabalenka, the best female tennis player in the world. Yes, Irina Sabalenka, the world's number one female tennis player, coming out this week and saying, you know, of course, biological males should not play against the females. And then, well, there's been backlash to that in the WNBA, if you've been following, with some co-owners of teams chastising girls who have been expressing support of not wanting to have to play against biological males. And then you saw Stephen A. Smith, the big sports commentator, former ESPN guy, coming out and saying the same thing. So hopefully we're reaching criticality on that, as we are with small modular reactors. And we can get some votes done on that. The other thing I'm seeing in the midterm elections is this progressive wave, which you may have seen, felt, or otherwise read about, starting, this was 2 years ago at this point. I think it was 2 years ago, maybe a year ago, the election of Mamdani in New York. And his policies are starting to play out. Specifically this week, I saw, you know, he's talking about opening these grocery stores, which is essentially socialism, right? These government-owned grocery stores. And he's going to offer wares, products, vegetables, or says he is, sundries, for 30% discount to the market price. And you just wonder how he's going to do that. Well, higher taxes, of course, is the answer if he's able to pull it off, which he's not going to be able to do. I think the amount of grocery stores he plans on opening is, you know, nowhere near enough to sate a city of 10 to 13 million people. It's a headline experiment, to be sure. Something that gets clicks and that makes for a good headline, but that's not going to go anywhere to move the needle in terms of the affordability crisis, which is very real, the household budget crisis, or food insecurity, etc. Also, there's pushback from bodega and store owners, such that he's already facing significant sentiment with immigrants. They didn't form a union, but they formed like a lobbying group, and they've already raised $1 million. I'm talking about like Asian grocers and Latin American grocers and bodega owners that are opposed to this, right? Because why would you want to compete with a government-owned store that's selling products at a 30% discount to market? So immigrants themselves and folks in the city don't want this. So
And then, you know, across the country, you've got this wave of progressivism, whether it's the Minnesota gubernatorial ballot, candidates I've seen elsewhere. And I've talked about this before. It's an obvious backlash to the status quo, to not getting any good answers from neither Biden nor Trump over the past, it's been 10 years, right, since Trump was elected. And as I often say, the debt keeps growing, the bombs keep dropping, the M1 money supply continues expanding, the value of your dollar, not the DXY, which I talked about earlier, but the value of your dollar, what it buys in real terms, not CPI bullshit terms, has gone nothing but down. You feel it at the grocery store, and there's been no good alternatives. So I guess what I'm cautioning about is the rise of socialism, favorability in the United States, because that's not the right answer either. So I guess that's my little talk on that. Not much of a rant, but get out in the ballot this fall and vote. Vote how you wish, of course. You're an individual, but keep in mind that higher taxes, government spending has not been the answer. I mean, if it was, with $40 trillion in debt, we would have fucking solved some things by now, right? Test scores would be improving, et cetera. But instead, inflation runs at 4% or post-COVID 8% after they mailed out the checks. And your purchasing power continues to go down while members of Congress and the Senate's net worth continue to go up. Last word on the Spokane fires. It's been a tragedy here in Spokane. Something like 65,000 people evacuated, 700 to 800 structures damaged. We've known folks from school and from sports that have been evacuated, some of whom still don't know if they have homes. And so just a call out to them. Lots of conspiracies, misinformation, all kinds of stuff floating around out there about the cause of the fires. Everyone's trying to get on their soapbox, whether it's folks on the extreme right talking about its conspiracy and tying it to fires in Maui and California, or folks on the extreme left, like former Governor Inslee immediately here in Washington, blaming it on climate change, where of course, as things mostly are, truth is somewhere in the middle. So we know now the biggest fire was started by an arson. He was previously convicted of manslaughter for killing his father, for telling him to do the dishes. So as Chris Curl said the other day, you know, a real stable individual there. But that points back to the justice system, right? And one, you wonder how you can kill your dad and get manslaughter and not at least second degree murder. You wonder how you could already be out of prison. This same gentleman was also investigated last summer for starting fires. Was in fact wearing the same t-shirt he was wearing last year when he was caught on camera and investigated for starting fires. And he was content this year to take some windproof, waterproof matches and a lighter and set a field on fire that led now to a 6,000, 7,000 acre fire that, as I said, has displaced 65,000 people. Extremely smoky here in Spokane, unhealthy air for the past, whatever it is, 5 days since the fire started. And of course, climate change, or whatever you call it, exacerbates those fires. I mean, less moisture in the earth, fewer or less snowfall over the past winter, led to drier conditions. So it was obviously high winds, 40 to 50 miles an hour. A wetter spring led to undergrowth that then dries out and provides fuel for those fires. And so truth somewhere in the middle, right? And on both sides. One, justice system weakness, letting repeat offenders and serious criminals back out on the street. And we've seen that come back to bite us in multiple ways in multiple cities. We know that the folks out on the street, and I've chronicled this for a couple of years in a Twitter thread, or have been starting fires in and around Spokane. There has been definitely two arrests of people that had set multiple fires who were homeless. And we know that those that are out there doing that have multiple
arrests under their belt and are responsible for the bulk of the low level and petty crime in this city and in others. And then on the other side, environmental conditions certainly playing into it, as I said, which leads back to the way we generate power and the amount of power we need, and how we still don't have enough of it, and have been closing dams and not supporting nuclear enough. And then I guess last word, just to tie it all together, is I saw in France and in, I believe it was Romania. Let me click over there for a second. Oh, I don't have it open, but I believe it was Romania or Hungary. Either way, you know, it's been so warm that the rivers are too warm to cool the nuclear power plants. And so even that form of clean power has been coming offline. But they're so dependent on it that in the country who it's escaping me what country it was right now. I'm not going to click around to find it. But in Eastern Europe was blasting rocks to divert rivers to allow water into the nuclear plants to cool them down. That's how vital, going back to my uranium fundamentals of 10 minutes ago, that's how vital nuclear power is to these countries, that they're willing to alter the earth to change the course of the movement of rivers to supply the water to cool them down. And so hearts out to the Spokane fire victims, of course, and fire victims across the country. If you look at a map of smoke or fires in the western U.S., the entire western half of the country, west of Nebraska, seems to be on fire. So we'll be making some donations. We've already done so through our school, and I'm sure we'll do so eventually through our company as well. That's it for the free portion of the 375th episode of Investing in Bizarro World. I'll get into some premium portfolio picks as we do. But that's it, the 375th episode of Investing in Bizarro World. We'll see you back here next week on our normal schedule. Gerardo will be back. And I hope you have a good rest of the week and next week. We'll see you here for 376. Adios.